I'm very happy. I will be very short in my introduction to Stefan Sperl here. I know him well, and I very much admire the book that he produced a couple of years ago, Faces of the Infinite, Neoplatonism and Poetry at the Confluence of Africa, Asia and Europe. A long title, but it does indicate that his interests are very much more than just in Islamic theology, mysticism, etc., but looks at the spread of the ideas, in this case under the title of Neoplatonism, throughout Western European, Islamic, and even further, and even spreading further in world literature and thought. This afternoon, he's going to talk about the results of a new project which he's been involved in Tübingen after his retirement from the School of Oriental and African Studies, a topic on pre-modern aesthetics, and see sort of preliminary results maybe from this very interesting sounding project, and he's going to talk under the title Different Aesthetics, A New Approach to Sufi Texts.
Well, let me first of all say how grateful I am to be here, how privileged I feel to be in this magnificent new room after hearing a magnificent lecture, actually three magnificent lectures. I hope I can engage your interest in a subject which is related to what we've heard, but also stretches into other areas. Well, when David Hornsby asked me some time ago for suggestions for a title for the next Ibn Arabi Symposium, at that point I'd just been invited to attend a seminar at the University of Tübingen. And this was part of a multi-year research project called Different Aesthetics. The topic of the Tübingen seminar was, I quote, corporeal metaphors as media for staging the appearance of the divine. So that seemed remarkably interesting to me, and I thought it would be relevant also for Ibn Arabi studies. And I suggested it as a topic for our symposium in that slightly different phrasing you've heard today, the body as metaphor of divine self-revelation. Now, how come that a project on aesthetics produced this title? This is what I would like to talk about today. First of all, by explaining the aim and background of this project, then discussing its relevance for the study of religious and mystical texts in particular, illustrate this with two examples from Christian mysticism in a study that was spawned by this project, and lastly, talk at more length about an Akbarian poem, which comes from a bit further afield. It comes from Nigeria and is written in Hausa. Different aesthetics. Why different aesthetics and different from what, you want to ask? Well, it's different from modern aesthetics, which goes back to 18th century philosophy, and in particular to Alexander Baumgarten and Immanuel Kant. This aesthetics became hugely influential and determines aesthetic judgments of artistic production to this day. Its key principles, summarized in the simplest way possible, are these. The work of art is aesthetically autonomous and complete within itself. This means that its aesthetic value is independent of any practical, political, or religious functionality. The less functionally bound a work of art is, the truer it is art for this purpose. Very important. Then the artist is a free creative agent who aims at originality by defying established norms and conventions. Thirdly, the spectator or recipient of the art experiences it with what Immanuel Kant called disinterested pleasure, an emotion independent of any moral or ethical concerns in itself, so to say. Now, the Tübingen project arose out of realization that these principles are singularly inappropriate for pre-modern art. It can be illustrated best, for instance, with medieval art. To give an example, a Byzantine icon. A Byzantine icon has a religious ethical functionality. Secondly, it is tightly bound to cherished conventions. These conventions is what makes an icon an icon. Then the icon is experienced with devotional reverence. Disinterested displeasure should not come into the picture at all. So realizing this, the Tübingen Project decided to set out establishing a different theory of aesthetics, which sees art and social function not as different or separate, but as absolutely interdependent aspects of one entity, two faces of one coin. The result of this project started some years ago is a volume of papers which appeared in English only a month ago, translated from German, so it's brand new, edited and published by Annette Gero-Greiter and several other scholars. So what is involved in this? Let me first introduce it to you purely abstractly. This is an interactive model of the forces at work in aesthetic production and reception. Now, this model centers not on works of art in the modern conventional sense, but on aesthetic phenomena defined as all acts and artifacts whose production requires artistic processes and techniques. As this model makes no distinction between high art and artifacts of common use, it looks at all products of artistic production. Now, these aesthetic acts and artifacts are seen as conditioned by the interaction between two different dimensions. On the one hand, the logic of their technical and artistic design that you will see on the left, and that is termed the ontological dimension. On the other hand, there is the pragmatic and historic logic imposed by the social, religious, or political functionality these acts and artifacts are designed to exert. And that is termed the heterological dimension. These two dimensions are perceived to be of equal relevance for the understanding of aesthetic phenomena. The functionality of the aesthetic object is therefore no longer seen as incidental or even detrimental to its aesthetic value, as in modern aesthetics. On the contrary, functionality and aesthetic values are seen as interdependent aspects of one entity. Now, as you see in this graph, it centers on something called the figure of aesthetic reflection. What is meant by that? The aesthetic model defines it as a configuration manifest in concrete objects, texts, or institutions, which the dynamic relationship between the ontological and the heterological dimensions become most tangible. Now, I'll talk more about this term later, because I want to illustrate it concretely, what it means. At this point, let me say that this model is designed to be applicable to all acts and artifacts, including the manufacture of everyday objects, even like forks and spoons, because aesthetic design and practical function come into everything. But we here are interested in a particular topic, namely religious texts of religious expression and instruction. And here the model can be adapted as follows. The ontological becomes here the textual on the left-hand side. The heterological can also be called extra-literary or contextual. You will see in this graph arrows, the blue arrows that are moving. And these arrows represent what for the purpose of this model is called the movement of aesthetic energy. And it starts at the left top-hand corner, where I've written mystical theology. Mystical theology focuses on a particular notion, which the absolute divine transcendence. How is this to be expressed ontologically, textually, So we move to the left-hand side. We see, first of all, literary convention. Out of established literary convention, the writer takes a particular form that is seen to be appropriate. It can, in Arabic, for instance, be the Qasida, like Ibn al-Farid took the traditional Qasida, made it into a mystic Qasida. Once this decision is made, the next thing is linguistic design, imagery, rhetoric to fashion this text. Then we come to the most important thing, the bottom right hand, that what is this whole thing for? What's the social functionality? And here, for simplification's sake, there's only one word that counts, anagogy in Greek, ascent of the soul. This is what the whole aesthetic movement of aesthetic energy really is aiming to generate in these kinds of texts, to elevate the soul to that divine transcendence in the upper right-hand corner. So what you actually have here is a circular movement. And that circular movement actually never ends, because the moment the soul has been elevated to a notion of to experiential notion of divine transcendence, it will fall back again. It will have to start that movement over again. And all mystical texts are engaged in this particular circular movement all the time. Now, interesting thing is that this circular movement, when we look at it from the perspective of Neoplatonic cosmology, it mirrors the movement of the soul. The soul emerges on the left, on the right-hand side from divine transcendence. It moves into this world, and it moves back to it again. So a circular movement of the soul, what mystical writing really does is captures in artistic form the archetypal movement of the soul. Now, there's one important thing to say here. The task of this aesthetic energy in the circle is a supreme challenge. Why? Aesthesis means perception. What this energy has to do is to bring to perception by the senses what is, by definition, imperceptible to the senses, namely divine transcendence. How big this challenge is, can see in this simple graph here. We are dealing on the left-hand side with an earthly signifier. Language, literary convention, and what it mirrors, the world, corporeal images. And this instrument, this body of tools, is designed to give expression to what? To a divine signifier who is ineffable, incomprehensible, invisible, incorporeal. That's to say, the left in its task to express this is bound to fail. In mystical texts, therefore, the earthly signifier is always seen as provisional, merely indicative, but insufficient. It's asserted and yet negated. The result is what we know as apophatic discourse, in which knowledge of God is only accessible through the senses. Mukhtar Ali told us earlier about the way in which texts are simply one layer, if anything, even the lowest layer of what we can lay our hands on in practical terms with what we're talking about. But on the other hand, that earthly signifier is also ennobled by serving as an image, however imperfect, of the heavenly. The earthly, true, is a fruit of divine self-revelation, as we've heard deal about earlier, and that earthly holds a message, in Arabic an ayah, a sign, which is for us to decode. Here is the source of our theme, of course, the body as metaphor of the divine. That's the root of this particular concept in this very simple, very highly simplified graph. What I would like to talk about now is to give two examples from Christian mysticism to illustrate this aesthetic model. They are derived from this publication that I've just shown you and authored by Annette Georg-Reiter. And they illustrate how different the approaches to the same underlying theme can be in terms of what is being expressed and what is being enacted. And here we encounter someone we already encountered before, our dear friend Meister Eckhart on the right-hand side, and also somebody less well-known, the medieval mystic Mechthild of Magdeburg. And Mechtel's text is a poem entitled The Flowing Light of Godhead. Her form, literary form, is a dialogue between soul and God. Totally different from Meister Eckhart, whose literary form is a sermon, and who speaks about a scholastic exegesis of scripture. The function is also very different. For Mechtel, it is a personal function. It's her personal search for union with God, comprehension of God. And it is written in a very personal way, but in such a way that anyone who reads this text is inevitably invited to participate in it. That's quite different from Eckhart, where the public function of his sermon is the consecration of a new church, and the recipients are instructed, they're listening, but they're not directly sort of say, engaged emotionally straight away, like with Mechtel. So the perception is quite different. The aesthetic model is the same, but what's happening is really quite different. But let us see concretely what this actually means, what this difference means. For Eckhart, he's speaking about the following verse of the Revelation of St. John. I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God. The New Jerusalem for him here is a symbol of the newly consecrated church. But then he goes on to say, but really, the New Jerusalem is everyone's soul. We all can be a New Jerusalem, provided that we make ourselves holy. How can we do that? By purifying our soul to receive the divine presence. We can all be made new. How? If we have this divine presence within us, our soul is renewed. And then he comes to the word peace. Where does he get peace from? He gets peace from Jerusalem. The name of Jerusalem is the city of peace. So we can be at peace. How? If we return our soul to God, that's why we are at peace. And then he concludes his sermon with a new biblical text in which this particular mental state, that state of peace and joy occurs, namely in the Song of Songs, which is an image of the union between the soul and Christ. And with this image, he ends his sermon. But throughout this sermon, Eckhart stands apart as the wise guide, and the listeners sit and listen. Very different with Mechtel of Magdeburg. In Mechtel, there is no scholastic exegesis. There is an intense emotional enactment of a desperate search for a God who is both everywhere and nowhere, who both comforts the soul and rejects the soul. And it takes the form of a dramatic dialogue between soul and God, which goes through increasing stages of torment. At the beginning, in the earlier part, she says, I am on fire. Some pages later, you have taken everything from me. Some pages later, my flesh melts away. My blood dries up. My bones torture me. In the end, the speaker literally vanishes into the text, and then something astounding happens. Suddenly, the divine voice asks her to recite a poem. But the verses of this poem are not hers. What she recites is what she calls the heart's sweet sound, which is directly inspired by the divine presence. Her individual self vanishes. It's extinguished in this experience. And here's the poem. It's not easy to read, but I let you read it. Lord, your blood and mine are one untainted. Your love and mine are one inseparable. Your garment and mine are one immaculate. Your mouth and mine are one unkissed. In this triumphant union in the one, solace is finally found after extreme anguish. That anguish now appears like the death of the self, which makes way for a spiritual rebirth in union with the divine presence. To focus on oneness brings to mind the concept of the One, the first principle of Neoplatonic philosophy, whose echo is discernible in all medieval mysticism, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim. And the way in which the aesthetic theory I've mentioned to you can be seen to be applicable to Neoplatonic aesthetics is a very big and fascinating topic for us to examine. But we can't do it here, because now I'm going to a new example that I'd like to talk about. It is entitled As-Sabun al-Mutahhir li-Ahdi at-Tarbiyati wal-Irfan, the cleansing soap for the people of Gnosis, for the people of spiritual training and Gnosis. The author is Muhammad Balarabi of Shellen Adamawa State in Nigeria. He died in 1967. And his poem has been translated and discussed by Andrea Brigaglia of the Orientale in Naples. And I owe to him both the text, the commentary, the permission to talk about it, because I think it's really quite a remarkable poem, which I would like to share with you. It's written in Hausa, as I said, and I do not know Hausa, so I owe Andrea Brigaglia even more thanks for having enabled me to talk about this. And what is the background of this poem? This poem is written in the tradition of the Tijaniya Tariqa, Tijaniya Sufi Tariqa, which goes back to Ahmed Tijani, a Senegalese luminary, who died in 1815. And this Tijaniya Tariqa became widespread in West Africa. And then a new man came along called Ibrahim Nias, who died not too long ago, 1975, who became an extremely prominent representative of this tariqa and was the founder of the so-called Jama'at al-Faida. The Jama'at al-Faida, the community of Faida. We heard a lot about Faid earlier, you know, the overflow of bounty. This is the unity, the community of the flood of bounty. And this is a particular version of the Tariqa of Tijaniya that became widespread, especially in North Nigeria. And Andrea Brigaglia, whom I just mentioned, has studied the writings of this group of this particular Tariqa. And he was amazed to find that over the last 80 years, some 200 authors produced some 2,000 works in Arabic and Hausa in a range of genres emanating out of this tradition. An amazing wealth of texts, which is practically unknown, and which he is currently writing a book about. And this poem that I'm going to talk to you about today, by Muhammad Liman Balarabi, is one of the fruits of these efforts. It exists only in Xerox form. The original has not actually been published. Here, by the way, I just, in the meanwhile, show you a picture of, this is Sheikh Ibrahim Nias, who is, by the way, a prolific author of Arabic poetry, remarkable Arabic poetry, discussed recently by Oludamine Ogunnaike in a major publication on West African religious poetry. So Nias is the great inspiration behind this poem. The poem has 163 verses, and it is addressed to an aspirant Sufi called Aminu. Now, this Aminu is well-trained in theory. He knows all the texts, but not yet in practice. So the poem shows Aminu the path to purification, edification, and the ascent of the soul, in keeping with the teachings of the Tijaniya Tariqa. And there you will be happy to hear, we will also encounter Ibn al-Arabi. Now, this wonderful Sabun al-Mutahhir is very long. I can't discuss all of it. I'm only going to focus on selected extracts, and they are chosen to illustrate what I called earlier the concept of aesthetic energy. Now, this aesthetic energy has three different but interrelated aspects. There's, first of all, an aspect that directly emerges out of the interaction between the ontological, that's to say the textual, and the heterological, that's to say the contextual or extraliterary aspect of the text, How do these combine? How are these combined to generate what I call aesthetic energy? Secondly, the range of linguistic devices used to bring this off. And lastly, the functional relevance of the text. What is the text actually aiming to achieve? What does it, in what way does this text aspire to change the life of the recipient? Because really that's what it's all about. It's designed to be life-changing. If it isn't, it fails. Now, how do these three types of energy relate to the poem itself? We can illustrate this here by applying to the poem the aesthetic model I showed you earlier. We start at the top. Here you see again the four arrows, four circular arrows. We start at the top right-hand corner, where we have the conceptualization, the theory behind it, and the focus is tawhid. That is the essential thing. In the other graph, I called it divine transcendence. Here I use the Arabic term, which is found in the poem, tawhid, the assertion of the absolute oneness of God. This is the topic of the poem, from beginning to end, you will see. Now, how is this underpinned intellectually? By the theology of Al-Ash'ari, Al-Ash'ari theology, the metaphysics of Ibn Arabi, and the prophetology of the Tijani Tariqa. We'll see how this works. This conceptualization in this poem is made manifest through the Qasida form, a particular Qasida structure, which I call an anagogical Qasida structure, a Qasida structure designed to generate the ascending movement of a soul. Its linguistic design is a very interesting combination of Arabic and Hausa. They are clearly Aminu, to whom this poem is addressed, knows Arabic and Hausa both. There's lots of Arabic in this poem. Now, this Arabic is there to give the intellectual content, the actual intellectual foundation of the text comes from these Arabic texts. But there's lots of Hausa without any Arabic at all, which is full of and attempting to generate, explain the emotional impact of knowing this intellectual baggage. So Hausa and Arabic work together at different levels, very powerfully. There is the second source of the energy. Now the third one, the social functionality, the poem is quite clear what it is. The social functionality is what? Tarbiyah, edification in Arabic, but it really is Tarbiyah is the experiential knowledge of Tawheed. Not knowing Tawheed as an intellectual concept. It is to experience the meaning of Tawheed. That's what Tarbiyah is. And once you get that, you come to the result of all this, which is Tarqiyah. Tarqiyah is anagogy. It is the ascent of the soul. It's the Arabic term for rising up, the Tarqiyah. So here we have the circle, the circle of aesthetic energy, manifests in the structure of the poem. And why does it work? It is because this structure forges the contextual dimension, namely the theory behind the poem, into a textual sequence, which is clear-cut. It has a clear-cut momentum that moves from theoretical knowledge to metaphysical insight, and aims for transformation of consciousness. So that is the first source of this aesthetic energy. Now, I would like to, we are here in the Ibn Arabi society, so we have to also bring Ibn Arabi into the picture. Where does he come about? Well, in the center of the poem, we have a long section which deals with the Akbarian doctrine of the Hadarat Ilahiyya, the divine presences. And this theory of Ibn Arabi is taken in this poem via the intermediaries. Intermediary is one, is Sadruddin al-Qunawi, number two is al-Kashani, and number three, most important, is Ibrahim Nias. And then it is combined with the Tijaniya prophetology, in which the Prophet Muhammad has a very particular manifestation, again, derived from Ibn Arabi. And at the heart of the Tijaniya ritual is a particular poem, prayer called Salat al-Fatih. And this Salat al-Fatih, I've just explained this here. This Salat al-Fatih is here in English, O Allah, send blessings upon our Master Muhammad, the opener of what was closed, The seal of what hath gone before, the helper of the truth by the truth, and the guide to your straight path. Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina Muhammad al-Fatih lima ughliq, al-Khatim lima sabaq, nathru al-haq bil-haq, al-Hadi ila siratika al-mustaqim. Now, the central part of this poem takes Aminu through the five hadarat, the five divine presences, which are the stages of the cosmos. And in these five stages, in four of these five stages, this particular poem becomes key, or prayer becomes key. The lowest of these stages is Nasud, that is the sensorial realm, al-mulk also. This is the world, basically the material world that we know that we can hear and see. Above that is al-malakut, which is the angelic realm, the realm of images. And that realm is opened up, so to say, by the term al-fatih, from the salat al-fatih, the opener. And this second hadra goes from the first to the seventh heaven. Then we come to al-jabarut, which is the third level. It's the presence of the divine decree, and this is opened by the prophetic term from Salat al-Fatih, al-Khatim, the seal. This third hadra goes from the seventh heaven to the kursi, to the pedestal. And lastly, there are two other realms. These are the two realms of oneness. There is the lahut, which is the presence of the name Allah, which is opened up by the epithet of the Prophet Muhammad, Nasir al-Haq, the helper of the truth. And this lahut level is also the level of the Muhammadan reality, Haqiqah Muhammadiyah, and of the perfect man, al-insan al-kamil, and of metaphysical symbols in the Quran, like the qalam, the heavenly pen, the yad, divine hand. These metaphysical symbols, they all reside, so to say, in this fourth level, lahut. And lastly, we come to the highest level, the level Hahud, which is the presence of the name Huwa. And we heard from Gracia in her presentation about the name Huwa, the highest name, so to say, which combines in terms of the our pronunciation of it, the deepest and the highest point of how we pronounce words with the Ha and the Wow. And this is the level which is also known as Hadrat al-Ghaib al-Mutlaq, the level of absolute absence, inscrutability. It is the innermost ipseity of God. It's that level that we can never understand, the level of absolute transcendence. And what I'd like to read with you is the way in which the poem takes Aminu to this fifth hadra. Here it is. The poet says to Aminu, now look at the letter Ha, the word Al-Hadi. This is the Hadi, it's the word from the Salat Al-Fatih, which takes him to that level. So you can see that the letters of the prayer of the Prophet, the Tijaniyah, these letters are, so to say, used as guides that guide Aminu from level to level. And this letter Ha from Al-Hadi guides him to this Ha-Hud. And of course, you have Hadi and Huwa, you have the letter Ha there as well. So he says, and follow it to the Hadra of Ha-Hud. If you follow it until the Hadrat al-Dhat, and Hadrat al-Dhat is another name for this supreme level, you will become an accomplished servant. Accomplished servanthood, in actual fact, really means you will know how to worship God properly. Servanthood means knowing how to worship. Only when you reach that level will you know actually what it means to worship God. Now the next thing, he breaks into Arabic and he says, Al-Butun al-Dhati, do you hear me? Al-Amma al-Rabbani, truly. Al-Butun al-Dhati, it is the hidden depths of the essence. Here he uses Arabic to explain this ultimate secret of divine entity in the fifth level, Al-Butun al-Dhati. With Al-Amma al-Rabbani, truly, we come to Al-Amma that we heard a lot about earlier, the lordly cloud. And this Amar Rabbani, in actual fact, as Andrea Brigalia has established, is a direct hint at Ibn Arabi's blessing prayer of effusion, which has been famously discussed in enormous detail by Stephen Hertenstein and Pablo Benito. Why do we know this? Because this prayer of effusion is mentioned by Ahmad al-Tijani. It is mentioned by Ibrahim Nias. It's an integral part of the Tijaniya Tariqa school. And the first, as Ibn Arabi says in this prayer, Muhammad the Prophet is the first individuation overflowing from the lordly cloud. The lordly cloud sits in this highest level. The first thing that emerges out of this cloud is the Prophet. I read in Arabic, أول التعينات المفاضلة, here fight again, من العباء الرباني. The first of the individuations overflowing from the lordly cloud. Now, the author of the poem says, والعباء الرباني, truly, it is to be found there. So he's talking, he's using the Arabic term because to orient it, he says, this is to be found there, beyond the qalab, here's another Arabic term, beyond the divine pen. And the hand, here speaks Hausa, but what he means by the hand is the hand of God as mentioned in the Quran. And then he says, but think of the true hand. Don't think that we're talking about any old hand. It's the true hand, that ultimate hand, which is above in the fourth hadra, because he says beyond the qalam and beyond the hand. And that doesn't say more about the fifth hadra, because the fifth hadra is the hadra, the presence of absolute inscrutability. We cannot say anything about what it actually is, other than saying it is al-butun al-dhati, it is the hidden depths of the essence. So having now brought Narbi into the picture at the center of the poem, let me go on to what I call the second source of energy, the range and constellation of linguistic devices deployed to bring the aesthetic experience to bear. There, particularly, I would like to highlight again this the role of bilingualism. Could see it here how Arabic and Hausa work together. I would like to show you now another example where the combination of the two languages brings the poem to its climax. And that brings us to this particular Quranic verse from Surah 51:56. وَمَا خَلَقْتُ الْجِنَّ وَالْإِنسَ إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونِ. I did not create the jinn and the humans except for them to worship me. What does this mean? Aminu, having reached the end of the poem, by that time should know what the Quran means with except for them to worship me. What does it mean to worship? What does it mean to worship? It is to know God as one, to know Tawheed. The moment you know Tawheed, in actual fact, your own oneness vanishes. You fuse into the greater one, and in that fusion, you really worship God. This is what it's. This is the target of the whole journey. And this is how the poem kind of explains to Aminu what is meant by "except for them to worship me." It says here. And I will actually, there are six lines. I'll read these six lines in sequence. And then I will I'll let you listen to the six lines in Hausa so you can get a feeling of how the poem actually sounds like in the language in which it was written. So the poem says, now Aminu, let's strengthen our resolve to know the Most High, the only one. Without knowledge of Him, all worship is worthless. The whole of religion is devoid of any sense. مَا خَلَقْتُ الْجِنَّ, he said. I did not create the jinn. مَا خَلَقْتُ الْجِنَّ, he said. And the insu, human beings, listen to the truth. Except that we may know him. That's what it means. And here, with explains in Hausa, with except that we may know him, what the Quran says, إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونِ, except for them to worship me. Except that we may know him, that's what it means. You see, God has revealed the truth, and here we come it. Without Tawheed, oh my brothers, the whole of religion is worthless. And know the Tawheed, the affirmation of the absolute oneness of God, oh my brother, Know that Tawheed, O my brother, is what we mean by the word tarbiyah. And this highly rhetorical and I think really effective combination of Arabic and Hausa illustrates what I would call the second language-centered source of energy. And here, hoping that it will work.
Aminu sai mu yi ta'anniya dan mu san ta'ala guda daya ba sanin sa ai babu ayyuka babu ko addini guda daya ma khalaqtul jinna ya fadi dude insu ko kaji gaskiya sai mu san shi dai shi ake nufi kaji jalla ya nuna gaskiya in fa babu tauhidi yan uwa an zubar addinu gaba daya don ka san fa tauhidi dan uwa shi ake nufi dai da tarbiya.
Okay, thank you. You just get a feeling of this, and of course what you hear is the famous monorhyme. It is the Qasida monorhyme manifest here in Hausa. Now, sorry, I didn't earlier show you the second half of those verses I was quoting, but there it is. So here you can see them in English again, except that we may know him. That's what it means. Here's the key thing. You see, God has revealed the truth. Without Tawheed, O my brothers, the whole religion is worthless. You know, Tawheed, O my brothers, is what we mean by the word tarbiyah. Good. We come to the end. You will be pleased to hear. The third source of energy, the practical, functional relevance the text aspires to have to the life of the recipient. Now, this aim is an experiential, non-discursive understanding of Tawheed as a gateway to Fana, the merging of the self into the one. And I'd like to illustrate this with two examples, which both have very long echoes, because they go all the way back to the Neoplatonic roots of so much mystical poetry. The first here is the incapacity of rational discursive thought to comprehend God and hence to achieve that goal. Now, Plotinus long ago already said, our awareness of the One is not by way of reason knowledge and intellectual perception. For reason knowledge is a rational process, and the rational process is many. And the process that is many can never, ever capture the One. No way. This is echoed in Meister Eckhart. The divine essence is not an essence to be grasped by human intellect. You've got to go into another dimension completely. Now, Muhammad Balarabe, as in affirming these very things, insights, tells Aminu point blank this: stop thinking rationally. Stop quantifying. He cannot be known except through tarbiyah, this process of edification that the poem is about. Another line he says, you, stop thinking of a measurable quantity. He is above description. It won't work like that. Now, these are just two examples of what is in fact a leitmotif that runs throughout this poem, the warning against tiresome and pointless efforts to understand God rationally. And the chain of transmission here can be traced all the way from Plotinus to Eckhart, from Plotinus to Balarabe, through well-documented intermediary stages. Now, my second example is the notion of oneness itself, Tawheed. Now, Neoplatonism should really be called in Arabic an Aflatoniya at-Tawheediya, Tawheedian Platonism, because Plotinus' entire philosophy centers on the ineffability of the One, the emergence of the many out of the one core, and the soul's return to its origin in the One as the meaning and supreme goal of human existence. The concept of oneness is central in the poem's compositional structure, even down to its monorhyme here, which rhymes with daya, the Hausa word for the numeral one. Significantly, daya, figures as rhyme word no less than 56 times, including the first, the central, and last lines of the poem. And with these examples, we'll reach the conclusion of this talk. Now, in the first line, the poet reveals the spiritual insight which has given rise to the entire work. Here's the first line. He says, at the very beginning of the poem, I surrendered and I saw the real. I saw all spiritual fathers become one. Who are the spiritual fathers? Goes on to explain. They are, first of all, the Prophet Muhammad, and Ahmad al-Tijani, founder of the Tijaniya Tariqa, and Ibrahim Nias. These are all the spiritual fathers. They are all one. Why? Because the message is one, and the message stems from the one. He's talking really about one thing, about a path that leads back to the one. Now, the second example is line 83. Now, line 83 is the exact central line of the poem. It occurs straight after the passage I read to you earlier about the fifth hadra, the fifth divine presence, the highest. There, straight after, at the center of the poem, he says, the five hadras I've mentioned are here in us, in each one, inside each one. Each human being is an image of the microcosm, of the macrocosm, an image of the one enfolding the many. We're talking of images which represent a psychological process that's happening within us. It's not one that happened yesterday or that will happen tomorrow. It's one that should happen right now, here. And we're reminded here of Meister Eckhart's New Jerusalem. The New Jerusalem image he talked about in his sermon is a newness which should happen in us now. It's a psychological, these are images of a psychological process that we carry within ourselves. Now, in the concluding lines of the poem, Daya provides the rhyme three times in succession. Here, the absolute sovereignty is asserted for the one God. By contrast, the poet as agent vanishes altogether. He even disclaims his own authorship of the poem. Familiar echoes. He says, O blessed Lord, my sovereign, to you belongs all power as one. You are the author, not me. I didn't proffer any letter, not even one. For I am not. So how could I possibly claim to have power? I have no speck of it, not one. Remember here how Mechthild of Magdeburg vanished in her poem, and all that was left was the one into which she fused. You see the same process happening here. You see the same process that we had earlier when Mukhtar Ali talked to us about Ibn Arabi's authorship of the Fusus al-Hiqam. He is not the author. The author vanishes. Something else has taken over. We're talking here about a universal phenomenon and a certain consciousness suddenly is fundamentally transformed. So when introducing the Tübingen model of aesthetics, I spoke about the concept at the center of their theory, the figure of aesthetic reflection, in which the dynamic relation between the heritological and ontological dimensions of the artifact crystallizes in the most tangible way. Where is it in this poem? There can, I believe, only be one answer. The figure of aesthetic reflection in this poem is the concept of Tawheed, the concept of divine unity. This concept is the topic at the core of the vast theological and metaphysical edifice, which supplies the poem's extra-literary and hence heterological dimension, Asharism, Akbarianism, Tijani, prophetology. But Tawheed is also at the core of the experiential perception which the poem aims to engender in the reader, in the listener. It's the core of its bilingual fabric. It's the core of its language, even down to its mono rhyme one, daya. And last but not least, giving expression to Tawheed as a transformative experience is a life-changing objective of the aesthetic energy of this poem. Very brief concluding remarks. They project different aesthetics, mainly aware of the crucial role played by the aesthetic process in texts of mystical instruction and in religious art altogether. In Balarabi's text, and I think in all great mystical poems, what happens is that the aesthetic experience and the religious experience mirror each other to such an extent that they actually become one. They become one in the experience of Tawheed. In fact, you cannot experience Tawheed without aesthetics and religious experience becoming one and the same. There can no longer be a distinction between the two. Then aesthetic energy is actually the force that enables the psyche to go beyond rational strictures and cross the boundary between immanence and transcendence. Because expressing the ineffable through language, expressing the imperceptible through perceptible, is the supreme aesthetic challenge. And that challenge can only be met artistically, aesthetically. It can only be met by figurative language, by metaphor, by circumlocution. These are the only means to express the inexpressible, because rational discourse fails here. Finally, Neoplatonic philosophy, the Christian mysticism of Mechtel and Eckhart, and the Tijaniya Sufism of Muhammad Balarabi use completely different images and frames of reference. But in their very difference, they are manifestations of one tradition with a myriad of faces. Thank you.